there can be coarse language and adult concepts in our program. So please watch out for little ears that might be running around if you've got your podcast playing, or pop on some headphones, and that way no one can get offended but you.
If you want to live your best life, you have to take responsibility for what's not working, and you have to stop blaming other people for where your life is at.
You're listening to the Rights for Women podcast, where we talk everything women and writing. I'm Kel Butler, podcaster and wannabe author.
And I'm Pamela Cook, author of 4 published books and a professional writing teacher. Together, we created the Rights for Women podcast to celebrate women writers and support women's rights.
Every Friday fortnight, you can look forward to an hour of Rights for Women dropping in your feed. We'll start with half an hour of chat with some brilliant female, trans or non-binary author. And whether you're a reader or a writer, you're going to love our chats on the Combo Couch this year.
In the second half hour, Kel and I will be chatting about the writing themes and challenges that resonated with us most out of the interview, both as women and as writers. So, if you are a woman writing,
or if you like women in writing,
if you like women who write,
or writing by women,
then the Rights for Women podcast is for you.
Listen to all of our episodes at www.rightsforwomen.com or subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your pods. Hi there, this is Kel. I just want to give everyone a heads up as to the conversation you're about to hear between myself and Jackie. It's not what you would expect. I'm not going to be talking about the Real Housewives of Melbourne. I'm not going to be talking about I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. And we do touch on the psychic medium abilities, but that's not what this episode is about. Sorry to disappoint. This episode actually goes deeper into Jackie's own experience of an emotionally abusive relationship, the impact that had on her and how she extricated herself from it and managed to change her situation. And it also goes deeper into her sister's incredibly violent situation and how Jackie was a big part of protecting both her sister and her nephew from living with a man who could very potentially have killed them both. So please, if you are a person who is dealing with this situation in any way, shape or form, whether it be yourself, whether it be through a friend or a family member, if you suspect anybody out there is living with this, please reach out. Please reach out to them or to 1-800-RESPECT, because 1-800-RESPECT not only supports the victims of domestic violence and the survivors of domestic violence, but they support the families and friends who do not know what to do when they know someone or suspect someone is living with domestic violence. The big message coming out at the moment is that we can't stay silent, that we can't turn a blind eye, that we must step up and do something and say something, because our women are dying. Our kids are dying, whether it be by the hands of someone who loves them or by their own hand as a result of the emotional trauma it all causes. So I beg of you, if you yourself or you suspect somebody you know is dealing with domestic violence, please reach out to 1-800-RESPECT. You will find nothing but respect, compassion, and care on the end of those lines, no matter what you want to do, or even if you don't know what to do. But please reach out, because that first step could actually save a life. Having said all of that, we really want you to enjoy this episode. Jackie is incredibly hopeful, positive and inspirational in the way that she talks. So even though we're talking about difficult subjects, we're trying to do it in a really positive way. So we really do hope you enjoy this conversation. And then the conversation that Pam and I have, taking it all a little further. I am so excited to be speaking with Jackie Gillies today. Most well known, I would suggest, in this country particularly for her place on The Real Housewives of Melbourne and also on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, but also for being one of Australia's most intuitive, most tuned in and connected human beings. She calls herself a psychic medium. I prefer to call her an intuit, because I believe that what Jackie is talking about, what Jackie is connecting to, is so much more than what we call psychic. It's tuning into the energy, as she says, of the universe, the energy that connects all living things. So I have the great privilege of being able to speak to her today about the book that has just been released, Shine It Up, which follows on from the amazing tour that she had last year, her Shine It Up tour, and the entire premise of which is to help others learn how to find their shine. Thank you for being with us, Jackie.
Oh, my God. I feel absolutely honoured to be here with you. And I always say we attract the right people in our life at the times and places, and there is no such thing as coincidences. Hence, I thank you for interviewing me right now and being on your podcast.
Well, let the Mutual Admiration Society begin.
Yes, honey. I love it.
Now, I would suggest that there would be a lot of people who would think that you have reached the great heights, that you've been on major television series, you've done your Shine It Up tour, now you're releasing a book, you are well respected in your field despite any of the skeptics out there. But I think they're wrong. I think this book represents your beginning. I feel like everything you have been doing up till now is laying your foundation for what you're actually going to do in this world, and you have just begun. Would I be right?
You are very right. You're the psychic medium right now, aren't you? You're already my energy girlfriend. You know what? As you were speaking to me, I was picking up a lot of goosebumps and I was feeling your angels and really connecting with you, and what you're saying to me is absolutely spot on. I believe that I needed to write this book at this very moment in time because it was almost like I was guided to it. I was asked to actually write a book when I was 24 years of age. I started doing psychic mediums at medium readings at the age of 24. And because I was still going through that toxic relationship that I was in and still figuring my stuff out and learning how to love myself, I wasn't ready to share my story. But I knew when I was in, I went on a reality show called I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. And when I was in the jungle in South Africa, I really reflected, and I do that every day, but this was on a much deeper level, because all you have to do in the jungle is just think about your life. And mine was more about what can I do next that can help people on an even more greater level? What can I do? What can I do to bring awareness to people? And I kept hearing again a book. So I started manifesting in the jungle. I started projecting and visualizing what I wanted to write about. And when I came out of the jungle, the universe was responding to me. And I'm talking about manifesting here, guys. It was responding to me. And when I came out of the jungle, there was two publishers that hit me up almost instantaneous within a week of coming out, saying, out of the jungle, we would love to write a book with you, Jackie, and would love you for you to share your story about what you've gone through. And so I met both of the ladies, and Sophie, my publisher that will be speaking to me tonight, she was the one I felt connected to because she's a yogi teacher. She also is very intuitive. She's connected with energy, and there is no such thing as coincidences. And she was the person that I was attracting in that moment. And hence we have a book, Shine It Up.
And so from Shine It Up, what do you want people to take into their lives? What are the three key things that are most important for you that people walk away from, both from your book and from your tours? Because these, both of those have a purpose.
Yeah. First thing I want to say, I'm going to say 3 points here, but I'm going to go really think about the first one. I'm not thinking about it, it's just coming to me. Thank you, angels. Is that you are enough. You have the power that all combines. You have the power and you are enough. And the beginning is you acknowledging your inner power, and that anything that you choose or want in life, or live the best version of your life, you need to realize that you have to start with taking responsibility for what's not working. So you are enough to be inspired by my book, but also to love yourself unconditionally. And that's the biggest thing I've learned over the years. I mean, I'm still evolving. I'm just like everybody else. I'm still on this spiritual journey like everybody else. I don't know everything. I'm just attuned to what I hear, and I have faith in what I hear. So for me, it's about you are enough, you have the power, and to love yourself unconditionally.
So in order to be able to write a book, in order to be able to tell your story, you had to first find out how to do that for yourself. And a big part of that was actually coming out of a traumatic situation with an ex-boyfriend, Paul, who sounded horribly controlling,
yes,
quite emotionally abusive.
Yes.
There's a part of your book where you talk about how your dad was a huge influence on you being able to step out of that and out of the mindset that it created. Can you talk about his really important influence on you in that moment?
Yeah. Growing up, I was raised in a very cultural, because my father's Croatian, I'm Croatian born. So I kind of had the two cultures, living here in Australia, but also still having the influence of Croatian culture. So my dad was very, very much on my sister and I having self-respect for ourselves. That means from my dad's point of view, and I actually really thank him for instilling this in me, was to really love your body, love who you are. Nobody else has control over your body, and not to just go out there willy-nilly with a man or a woman, whatever I decided to, you know, whatever. I was still figuring myself out. And so for me it was not to just go out there and sleep with somebody for the sake of it to get attention. That was the first lesson my dad was teaching me. So without realizing it, what my dad was doing was instilling a sense of self-worth in that time when I was growing up in my formative teenage years, and also to be resilient, because my father came to this country with $5 in his wallet, and my father is the most giving human being you'll ever meet. If you come to my house now and there's a sausage in the fridge, my dad would give you that sausage, and that's how I was raised. And my dad's very big on loyalty, and so am I. I was always about, I didn't allow people in my life that were disloyal or dishonest and weren't truthful. And I was like that for a long time until I stepped into that relationship with Paul. And so resilience, self-respect, and loving yourself and that you are enough. And so that was the keys that really played when I look back in my life growing up. And I was a very respectful girl. And a lot of the guys, when I look back, actually, a lot of the guys would be like, they'd try and crack on to me and they couldn't. They couldn't understand why. And that was because my dad had instilled, when you kiss a guy or you want to sleep with a man, do that if you love him and just don't do it because you want attention. And what I have found over the years, a lot of men and women do things the wrong intent because they're looking for attention outside themselves. That means they're not looking within. So my dad was predominantly teaching me to know my power within myself.
So your dad instilled that in you and in your sister.
Yes.
And my dad instilled it in me. All three of us ended up in abusive relationships.
Yeah.
What is going wrong?
Oh, I could tell you what's going wrong. For me, because my dad instilled the loyalty and instilled the self-respect, so being with that boyfriend, I thought that I've got to stay loyal to him. I've got to stay loving towards him because my dad said that, you know, this is when you sleep with a man, so I kind of felt guilty. Now if I go off with another man, what am I going to look like? Am I going to look like somebody that is sleeping around? Am I going to look like somebody? And I wasn't into that. So for me, it was about being loyal to him, being and knowing that he was my first, that if I now shied away from what I was doing, it would be like, maybe this is going to be embarrassing to me by going with other men. And it's not that I was looking at doing it. The fact was, I feel like I attracted that relationship because loyalty was a big thing for me. So I stayed around. And during that time, when I met that guy, in the first 6 months, I was always my confident self, but then he started isolating me from my friends. And it started really slowly. And I didn't really click on this probably until maybe 5 years ago that I really realized, shit, I allowed all of this to go on and he was doing it very slowly. And that's what happened to my sister, very slowly. So in the first 6 months, oh, my God. And then he'd start saying, because I was so confident, then he'd start saying, you know, I was born under a shining star. You know that I'm a good-looking guy. You know my friends are jealous of me. So what he was trying to do is take that confidence away from me because he knew that if I kept that confidence up, I'm going to see through him. So it was little by little, chip by chip, and me trying to stay loyal to him because of what I've seen in my parents. That's what I believe, or why I believe I attracted that. I stayed in it too long because I was being loyal to a man that was being disloyal to me. I believe I attracted that because on a soul level, it's like you need to learn, girl, because you're going to be teaching other people later on.
You talk also about the good girl syndrome.
Yeah.
And how you really had that syndrome. Yeah. I think a lot of us have that syndrome. I'm hoping the next generation of girls are going to have it less.
that they don't have to be good girls and please all the time. And but certainly my generation, the generations that have come after me and generations that went before me all live with the good girl syndrome.
Yes.
I attribute that very strongly to the number of women who do end up in domestic violence situations. What do you think?
Yeah, I believe that as well. But I also believe that when I kind of put all of that aside for a second, and I really, really meditated on this over the years, why I attracted this, it's because I believe that I had to elevate myself spiritually to a point where I realized it, or I could have just been sitting on a revolving belt, but something yearned inside of me that I needed to get out of that. And so, yeah, I do attribute that, but I also attribute that I didn't love myself enough to realize it. And I had the love from my parents, but it's a different kind of love, you know, when you're with a partner than it is from your parents. And because I, you know what I also feel too, is that a lot of these guys, or women, you know, women and men, they're both in, people can both be, it's not just one gender, it can be male or female here, is that I feel like this person knew my personality and knew that I was this genuine, good, loyal girl, so he took advantage of that, but I allowed it. So I don't just want to say it's all like that, but I feel like a lot of abusers look for that type of energy in a woman.
Yeah, see it as a vulnerability and use it against them.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think – now I want to sort of move from there because you had that experience and then you had your sister and that's a whole different experience.
Yeah.
What was it like, because in your book you talk about how you saw what was going to happen to her if she went with that man and married that man, Derek.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you told her this and she attributed it to jealousy?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Which completely understandable as well, because you always make excuses for why these things are happening. But then over time you were picking up on the bruises and you were picking up on things that were happening and you'd ask and the shame would always take over. The shame is what keeps us quiet, I think, shame and embarrassment. And then there was that night where you were babysitting Goran. Do you mind talking through that night and how you felt as someone who had already gone through something who could have ended up there?
Oh, absolutely.
And knowing that you'd warned
my sister.
Yeah.
For me, I was – when I received the phone call, I'll never forget it, my husband and I were in Newcastle laying in our bed and we just had put Goran down and my nephew, and I believe the universe put Goran in our place at that moment in time, because God knows what could have happened if Goran was there when all this went down. And my sister rang me a couple of times. I remember looking at the phone and going, she's probably had a few drinks and she's loving herself sick out at the birthday party that she went to. So I didn't answer. And then she rang again and she was in a panic. She was screaming, "He's hitting me, he's hitting me." And I said, "Who's hitting you? What's happening?" "He's hitting me, he's hitting me." And she hung the phone up. And then she rang my mother. And I didn't know that. I'm trying to ring her and she's not answering the phone. And then we rang her back and we're talking to her, and she had run out of the apartment where she was staying and she was on the road and she was freaking out. She was traumatized by what had happened. And she started telling me what he did. And instead of crying, something clicked in me that got so angry. And Ben was trying to – what was really ironic about that is Ben is the most – my husband is the most calmest person you'll ever meet. And he took the phone. He was like, "Angela, calm down. It's all right." Because she just kept screaming, "He's hit me, he's hit me, he's hit me. I've got this bump on my head." So we just thought there was just this bump on her, but I knew it was more than that. But you couldn't see the bruises till the next day, really. So anyway, point is that my husband took the phone and he says, "Angela, where are you?" And it was almost like a blur. It was like I started getting angry, thinking I allowed this to happen. I knew that he was going to do this to her. I foresaw it before I met him. I never met him. I just saw the images of her being hit. And I remember when I saw those images, when she's told me that she was with this guy over the loudspeaker on her car phone, I rang my mother and said, "She cannot be with this man. He's going to hit her." And so I started getting angry. Did I let this happen? Did I let this happen? And Ben, in the meantime, talking to Angela, and he's talking to my mother, and I don't even know. This is like a big blur. And got my mother and my father to where my sister was, where the closest police station was. It's like, it just, I can't even tell you how it happened. It was almost like, it was like a blur. But my husband got my sister to a police station and my parents to the police station, which was like an hour and something drive to this police station. But so they got there, and my mother said that in the meantime, she had rung my mother. This is before she had rang me, and she hadn't answered. Then she's rang me, and then she's rang mum back. And this, so this is before now, when I'm telling you the story of my sister ringing me. And she was crying to my mother saying that, mum, I'm locked in the cupboard and he's hitting me. He's trying to grab me. So he's trying to get me by my hair, pull me out of the cupboard. She locked herself in the cupboard so he couldn't get to her. And my mum's answering the phone. She's got the phone in the cupboard saying, mum, help me. My dad, came out, and mum's face was wide, and mum just said, Ivan, just grab the keys. Didn't have to hear anything because my dad's very psychic, and screamed at mum, get in the fucking car now. And they flew down to where my sister was. They get to the police station, and it's like the angels stuck someone there. And this guy I went to school with knew me. So he's trying to calm her down by deflecting and talking about something else. So he starts talking about me. I know, Jackie, oh, my God. And my sister's like going, oh, my God, you don't know how what my father's like, you don't know what my brother's like. I just think she was just traumatized. And so the next day when Angela came home, it went home with mum and dad. So Angela, mum told me there was just a bump on her head when they drove her home, so you couldn't see what happened. And the next day my sister's, you can Google up, because my sister was in 60 Minutes because of what had happened to her. She was interviewed. And her whole face looked like a cauliflower. She was probably 5 centimetres away from being comatized. It was that bad, that traumatic. And she was still making excuses for him because she was ashamed and embarrassed. But we all stepped in and she wasn't going back. But in the book you see that she went back one more time to see – when I say one more time, she went back for 1 hour to talk to him and didn't tell anybody to figure out why. She's trying to make sense of this. And I think because her self-worth was so low, she's trying to say what to – like she just wanted an answer. And she couldn't get that answer because she was dealing with a man that lies, and that's what abusers do, and they always make out, I'll never do it again. It's your fault. I love you so much. Please take me back. So I stepped in and said to my sister, I will use every resource that I have to make sure that you are seen as an unfit mother, because I have a nephew that I know that he's going to be abusive towards physically, and he was only 7 months old, and I'm the godmother of that child, and I don't care, I'm stepping in. And my sister didn't go back, but I believe that that was through prayer, and that was also through prayer of all of us, but also by me making a decision to stand by. And I will tell you, when she was being hit before she went into the carpet, he pinned her down, he was hitting her. She heard a voice, which I know was, her godfather, heard a voice in her head that was outside of her, in her head, but also outside of her ear, both. Like she couldn't understand what she was hearing, but it said to her, grab his balls, twist, and push up. She grabbed his balls, twist, and pushed up because she couldn't get him off her. And in that moment, he released and she pushed him, and that was a moment for her to run. But she heard that voice tell her.
Do you think she would have survived had she not done that?
Absolutely. I believe that she may have been brain damaged, absolutely, for what she endured.
Yeah. That's a lot.
It is. It is. But you know what? I still struggle to. I'm all about the power of forgiveness. He's the one person I skip every single night, the one person. But I had to tell her, I don't care if you want to hear this or not. You are a mother. And if you don't want to think about yourself, you need to think about that kid. Because if you don't think about the kid and you want to go back, Angela, I can't control what you do. But I'm going to make sure that that kid's looked after.
I was talking to someone from 1-800-RESPECT today because I'm helping with a resource for survivors of domestic violence who want to tell their story. And she was talking about how we have this attitude of friends and family when we see people in that kind of distress, and when their brains are trapped, their hearts are trapped, they're frozen. They are frozen. It, as you mentioned, it's like Stockholm syndrome.
It is.
100%.
Yeah.
You know, it took you a year or over a year to get past wanting this man and to stop redoing what he had already done to you.
Yeah.
And this particular lady said there's this syndrome where we think we shouldn't say anything. We shouldn't push too hard. We shouldn't interfere. Yes. We shouldn't interject. We shouldn't stop, say, hey, no, listen, this isn't good for you.
Yeah.
And she said we actually absolutely do have to start doing that.
Absolutely we do. And I think it begins with we have to educate young girls on, firstly, beginning to love who you are and having healthy boundaries. And I feel like the problem that we got going on now is it's generationally getting better, but the problem now that we have is one in four children commit suicide, and a big influence statistically was what they're saying is the birth of social media. Now, social media, it can be a positive thing, but it can be an incredibly negative thing. And I think that we've got to get back to basics where we have to instill that you are enough and you are worthy and you don't deserve that.
This comes back, I think, to a huge theme of your book and a part of what you've said is your life purpose, is personal responsibility and ownership of intention.
Yes.
What does personal responsibility mean to you?
Personal responsibility means to me that you need to look at your life, and you need to look at your life in a way that, how will I articulate this? Need to look at your life and look at what's not working, what is working. For example, you need to look at your life and stop blaming other people for why it's not working. It's not working because you have stopped allowing yourself to feel loved, or you've stopped allowing yourself to receive. You've stopped allowing yourself to be happy. So by taking responsibility means that what are the things that aren't making you happy? So for me, as a comparison, is that I had to take responsibility for what wasn't working. So I had to look at my lifestyle, had to look at the friends around me, and also had to look at the relationship that I was in. And the only way for me to push through was taking ownership that I allowed that to happen. The guy, yes, he was an abuser, but I stayed in this relationship knowing what he was doing. I knew that he was cheating. My gut feelings told me, but I didn't want to acknowledge it. I knew that his behavior was not normal, but I didn't want to acknowledge it. I was actually enabling him. So I had to stop all of that. So taking responsibility is look at what's not working and move to fix it. If you need help, go and speak to a psychologist or a counselor. If you need to speak to somebody, there's a friend or a family member, that means you have to open up the conversation. If you don't feel happy with yourself, you have to open up your conversation and be authentic. So taking responsibility is about being authentic to who you are, emotionally, physically, and spiritually, and it starts with being honest with yourself.
If we started instilling that in children,
yes,
what do you think the impact would be on our adults and our relationships?
Oh, man. Oh, darling, you'd be creating a life that you'd be creating the best version of your life ever. If we started instilling that in children right now as we speak, then they'd be growing up, and I feel like the abuse rate, the bullying rate would just start subsiding, because you wouldn't allow that energy into your sphere.
I know you and your brother particularly were badly bullied.
Yes.
You said in an interview actually that you blocked a lot of that out until writing the book. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah. I blocked it out until I was writing the book. And I'm going to tell you why I think I blocked it out. Not why I think, I know, is because I didn't want to acknowledge that people can be like that. And so for me it was easier not to remember. I remembered it, but I just pushed it to the back of my head. Well, like so many human beings do. When things are traumatic, you just push it to the back of your head. And when you're younger, it's like as you get older, you become conditioned by responsibilities and the way society works and blah, blah, blah. So you kind of push that to the back of your head because it's almost too traumatic or too sad to think about that. So for me, yeah, I was horrendously bullied, but I also gave it back. So I kind of feel a little bit, and this is in the book, feel a bit guilty saying that, but I shouldn't feel guilty because sometimes it gets to a point where enough's enough. And you know, there were times I remember coming home after having rocks thrown at me and thinking, I don't want to be here. Even after that relationship, when it ended, I just want to drive that car off the cliff. I don't want to be here. What's the point of it all? You know, I gave. But I never received back, but I didn't allow myself to receive. So yeah, it was, there were trying times. I remember putting that belt around my neck just to see how that would feel. And in that moment, I understand how a single thought of despair can take you a different way. And it can. But I remember doing that, but it's not like I thought I'm going to like take my life. It's almost like I wanted to punish myself for allowing myself to be in it. And by doing that, it was like, I was angry with myself, but I was too scared to go out of it because I thought this is amazing and this guy loves me so much and I wanted to betray this perfect, amazing relationship that was absolutely bullshit.
When you were fighting back and you say that you were guilty about that, I assume that's because it goes against the fundamentals within you. But it's also in the book where you say you, for the first time, you actually found what your personal power was.
Yeah. Personal power, knowing healthy boundaries and bringing my confidence back and knowing that I allowed, I actually gave my power away. It's as simple as that. I gave my power away, and for me to get my power back was taking responsibility. And that's the biggest practice I believe in anybody's life, and also the power of forgiveness. I literally had to forgive that person on a human being level so I could take that power that he still had over me away.
It's not about forgiving the act. It's about forgiving yourself for allowing yourself to be in that situation.
And in doing so, you remove the power they had.
Yes.
As well as giving yourself power.
Your power back. And that felt so liberating. And when I came back to the shine, shine, shine of Jax, it was on. I was unstoppable. There was no going back. And I just thought to myself, fucking hell, man, I actually allow myself to be mucking around for 5 years of wasted energy. But that's not wasted, because if I didn't go through that, I wouldn't be sitting here writing the book.
And you potentially wouldn't know what you wanted to be able to be open for Ben.
Correct. And I knew what I wanted in a relationship, and I wrote it on a list and I put it on a piece of paper, and I said that this is what I'm going to have, and I am going to sit and I'm going to wait for it, and when it comes, it's going to come. And I said, I'm not going to date another man again until I have all those things on this list.
But it was there for over a year. You were besties. Yeah. He almost had to convince you.
He did have to convince me. Let me tell you about that, Papa Bear. But I will say that I just knew that when I saw him and reconnected with him, we had the same dream. As soon as I reconnected with him, And I have to say that me waiting for the love that I have now, Ben, I prayed for a relationship that was unconditional love, without judgment, without conditions, and Ben is that and more. And I didn't think that existed. Being European, growing up in a European family, thinking, you know, you've got to do the right thing by everybody. I was the good girl listening to the parents. I was the good girl listening to the boyfriend. No, power is knowing what you want out of life to live the best life that you seek. So for me, God answered my prayers, and God for me is universal. Everyone's connected. So when I say God, it's not a person sitting up in the sky is judging. God for me is the water, the animals, you, me, the trees, everything. So he answered my prayers, he answered my prayers, and it was always going to answer my prayers, but I was the one that had to find that power in order to know that I was deserving of it.
It's almost like it answered your prayers on another level though.
Yeah, it did.
In that they gave you someone who was able to and equipped to guide you through the next stage of your life, through being on The Real Housewives, through dealing with social media, through putting yourself out in a massive way on a public sphere.
I will say this. When I say without conditions, without limitations, that's exactly what Ben does. He supports every single thing that I do. And in a lot of friends' relationships, I don't say that in their partners. They support them, but they don't support them to that level. Ben's a completer. If I say I want to do something, he takes me to the next level. And I'm so blessed to have that. He's my soulmate. He really is my soulmate.
There's so much I would love to talk to you about, but we've got to wrap this up. So back to the personal responsibility, because I do feel like that's like the core.
That is the core.
And
yes, it is the core of the book. Take your responsibility. If you want to live your best life, you have to take responsibility for what's not working, and you have to stop blaming other people for where your life is at.
I think that's the perfect place to end it, really. Thank you so much. Thank you for giving me your time.
I feel so blessed to have been sitting here talking to you, because you're on the same level as me, and I appreciate it.
So I bet that wasn't exactly the kind of interview you were expecting that I was going to do with Jackie when I said I was going to interview one of the Real Housewives. Is it, Pam?
Not at all, Kel. Not at all. And, you know, I think I said to you before you interviewed Jackie, oh, like, I'm not into The Real Housewives. I've never watched it. Not my thing. But so I was actually amazed. There you go. There's one of those preconceptions blown. I was really amazed at Jackie's interview, and the depth of emotion, and just her story was very, very hard to listen to in some ways, but also very inspiring.
And really important conversations I think we need to be having more of if we're going to break this cycle that's definitely prevalent in Australia of domestic and family violence and the rates that women and kids are dying. And as we said, it may not be by the hand of the person who loves them, but it might be later as a result of the trauma by their own hand because they just can't cope anymore and we've got to just stop it. So I think the biggest point for me that is coming out at the moment, one of the biggest points is the good girl syndrome. It seems to be a common factor that is setting our girls up to feel like they have to please everyone and put themselves in these positions of needing to please all the time instead of feeling okay with demanding respect.
Yeah, I think you're right, Kel, and that was something that really I made a mental note and a physical note of, you know, when Jackie was talking about that. And I've just come back from Newcastle Writers Festival, which was an amazing festival. If anybody hasn't been, make sure you get there, you know, in future years. But it was my first time there, but a fantastic cast of, you know, speakers. And the ones that really struck me the most that I've sort of come away thinking about over and over were Clementine Ford, Jane Carrow, and a woman called Gabby Stroud, who is an ex-primary school teacher, has written a book called, I think it's called Teacher or Classroom Struggle. And what all three of them were saying, I mean, we know that Clementine for years has been saying, you know, women need to speak up, women need to, you know, basically get angry. And she does that so well and so eloquently. But, you know, what Gabby and Jane were saying, and Jane actually said, we need to get angry, we need to speak out, like, for too long, you know, like in the teaching situation, Gabby Stroud actually talked about how she had been brought up as a good girl and she played the good teacher. You know, she sat in staff room meetings listening to all this bullshit about, you know, meeting all the NAPLAN criteria and all this stuff that was just basically meaning that she couldn't get into the classroom and teach her kids the things she knew they needed to have taught. And, you know, she sat there for a long time listening to this and being so frustrated and just, you know, finally starting to speak up. And it just got to the point where she could not stay silent. And, you know, it's the same sort of thing Jackie was talking about. And Jane Carrow was speaking about it, about in relation to her book, Accidental Feminist, which is about women of a certain age, which is around my age, you know, in their 50s and 60s, who basically, you know, were the first generation of women to earn their own wage, you know, that weren't sort of the housewife or just being a housewife.
Weren't dependent. Yeah,
not that there's anything wrong with that, but they were the first generation of women who were earning their own money. And
to truly acknowledge that they had a right and a space to be able to do that, I think, as well, to break free of that thought process that we couldn't do that.
Yes, but the sad thing is that the highest numbers now coming out about homeless people and homeless women are women of that generation, because they were in a workforce where, because they may have left to have children, or they worked part-time, or they chose to, you know, to separate their time between work and family, they had no superannuation. You know, that apparently this is the highest proportion of homelessness is in women over 50 and 60. So, you know, she was saying, like, this is, society has allowed this to happen. And, you know, she's sort of, it was a bit of a rally call for women to basically take back their power and just say, this is not good enough. You know, we will not stand for this sort of rubbish. And, you know, I think it just reminded me so much when Jackie was speaking. And I know, you know, we're going to go on to talk about other things, but that element of, I guess, first of all, it's recognizing that you have been silenced, and then,
yes,
and then, you know, actually speaking out about whether it's an injustice. I think sometimes it's harder. It's much harder if it's happening to you, but it can be easier in some ways to talk about things that are happening to other people. You know what I mean?
Definitely.
Like when you're in that situation, I think it can be very, very difficult to speak out, particularly
forest
if you feel
for the trees kind of thing.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. But I think there's definitely this collective sort of thing happening now where I think women are sort of coming together, you know, and that there was a lot of discussion, of course, around the Me Too movement and how that has mobilised women and allowed women to speak out, you know, and I think that is now spreading into other areas of, women's issues, not necessarily just the sort of, you know, sexual assault, domestic violence issue. But, of course, that's what Jackie was referring to.
Well, I think the good girl, that whole good girl syndrome that we're starting to see, that pervades absolutely every facet of life from the minute a girl is born all the way through. And hopefully, as of this moment, these generations coming through, these conversations being had, that that's going to change. But certainly previous to all of this, previous to this awakening that women are having about, hey, we need to stand up and say, no, this isn't okay, and take back our power and be angry instead of being passive about it. But there's definitely been this history where girls have been told, you need to please, you need to care, you need to be kind, you need to be compassionate, you don't rock the boat, you need to always be verbally and visually pleasing, and in every situation, not, and it's pleasing to the standard of the man. It's not a standard that was ever set or even discussed with women as to whether, you know, what is deemed pleasing. It's a standard that has only ever been set according to men to make their lives more comfortable, always, and for them to be able to just take what they want from the world rather than to even have the humility to ever ask of a woman. It's always assumed a woman will ask. It's always assumed a woman will apologize. It's always assumed a woman will back down. It's never assumed the same ever from birth of a man. And herein, I think, lies a real tragedy for women, which is we grow up believing already that we're disempowered. And that is not okay, because when we find ourselves in a situation with a man who is looking for that exact piece of disempowerment that society has instilled upon us so that these men can take us, when that man comes and looks for that disempowerment and that vulnerability that makes us woman to man, then they abuse us. They use it against us. It becomes the greatest weapon to keep us caged and trapped and held down, and eventually, a lot of the time, kills us, most of the time upon the moment we decide that we don't want to live without any power anymore. And we challenge that dynamic. So, first off, we need to kill this good girl syndrome, don't we? We need to really be just flipping that script in the way we have that discussion with our girls and the messages we're sending them about what they should tolerate as they're growing up. No, turn around and tell that guy to get his hand off your butt. Turn around and say, you don't use that kind of language around me. And say it's not okay. And don't worry about the reaction and how somebody else is going to feel, because they certainly haven't worried about how they made you feel in that moment.
Yeah. And look, Jane spoke about this in relation to sort of, you know, the older generations of women, some of whom were brought up in that society where, oh, look, if a man touched you up or did anything, you know, like that in the workspace or whatever, oh, look, he's just being a bit of a bloke, you know, and, oh, look, don't worry about it, get over it, move on. But that was the sort of society that, and I mean, to us now listening to that, it's like, what? Are you joking? But that was the society that they were, you know, that was the way they're indoctrinated. And, you know, I mean, I think we can pretty safely say that that is not acceptable anymore. And most women, I think, would agree that there is no way they would tolerate that. But having that mental sort of understanding of that, and then being put in a situation sometimes where you do feel powerless, even though you know mentally that this isn't right. You know, sometimes those sort of, I don't know, the pressures that are around you or the people that are around you, sometimes people, you know, women are still doing this. We're still allowing this sort of stuff to happen.
Well, that's exactly what you just said, though. It's because we've got this incredibly diverse mix of generations who have all grown up with different understandings now of what it means to be a woman and what rights a woman has and what is okay and what is not okay as a woman. Like what you just described then, only 15 years ago, I was living myself and I was trapped within my own internalized misogyny where I was just saying, yeah, whatever that guy's, you know, sexualizing my pregnancy bump right now in the middle of the workplace and talking about how much he'd like to sleep with me quite openly. But I'm just going to ignore that and giggle and laugh because I don't want to make me or anyone else feel uncomfortable. Now, if anyone dared to talk to me that way, I would stand up and very clearly say, you don't get to disrespect me or any other woman. How dare you? I am in a workplace. And even if I wasn't, you are violating my boundary and that is not okay and that should matter. Like, but 15 years ago, I was silent and that exact same situation happened over and over and over again in the workplace I was at. Why? Because I had the exact same attitudes, which was don't rock the boat, be pleasing to others. The same attitude that had me in a situation with a man who was beating me and I was apologizing, who I was questioning my own sanity because he constantly told me that I was worthless and that any power I displayed was a version of mental illness. So, you know, it's so hard to be a woman, I think, at the moment. If you're a woman from an older generation, you are fighting so many contradictory thoughts and patterns and reactions and understandings. If you're coming from the younger generation, you're sitting there going, how did these people let it happen? And we victim blame the different generations of women based on the way they reacted at different times. And it's so unfair, the amount of victim blaming we do to women.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing Jane Caro said. You know, somebody asked a question about, you know, different generations of feminism and what Jane's opinion was. And she said, look, you know, we're not all going to agree. We're human beings. You know, not every feminist is going to agree with every other feminist, whether you're from the same generation or not. But the main thing is that we're all fighting the same fight, you know, and that basically, you know, we should respect each other's differences just as we would respect anybody's difference of opinion. But keep in mind that, you know, the main push that we need to keep on with, and I think it's, you know, I don't know if it's a bad time to be a woman. I'm actually thinking it's a pretty good time to be a woman because I think...
No, I do too.
Yeah, I think it's actually a time when...
I'm excited for the women coming through.
Yeah, yeah, and I can really see it in my daughters, you know, who are in their late teens and 20s. I mean, I'm not saying that they would never put up with any sort of, you know, harassment or whatever, but I know damn well they would be a lot more outspoken than I was at their age. Like, you know, they are much braver and much stronger and much more opinionated, which is fantastic. Than, you know, and whether that's growing up in a family full of women too. And I think obviously, you know, I guess I've hopefully influenced them in some ways with that. But I do think it is actually the society they're growing up in too that is allowing that, you know, those voices to be heard.
Definitely. What they're seeing in the mess, like exactly what you were saying before about we don't have an enablers culture that they're growing up in anymore. We're now saying, no, don't laugh at that sexist joke, because what that says to the man is, hey, it's okay to be sexist. And what it says to the woman is, hey, it's okay for you to be sexually exploited and put up with it. What's wrong with you for thinking that you should not be sexually exploited? So, and that enablers culture, if we're crushing that, and in our schools we're not tolerating it, and in our workplaces we're not tolerating it, and women are allowed to have a voice for a change, and they feel powerful and supported speaking up, that's a whole different experience to what you and I and my mum and my grandmother have experienced in this world. So for women to be able to grow up with that, that is amazing. But I think the women growing up with it also need to understand that the women of other generations have had different lived experiences, and how they come to their own awakening and how they come to their own realizations about the experiences they've had, and whether they want to do that or not is up to them. And it's not up to us to judge them or put them down. It's unconscious bias, it's internalized misogyny, and it's fear. So much fear of what all this change means. Like, where is the place if you remove the place and shift all the boundaries and shift all the goalposts? That's a hard thing for women and men of different generations to adapt to. And I don't think we give enough support and compassion for the fact that people are trying to adapt at a really rapidly changing world. But can I shift the conversation for a sec?
Yes. Yeah, go.
Because as much as we're talking about, oh, I'm going to get really emotional. Sorry.
That's all right.
As much as we are talking about all this responsibility that women need to have for themselves and all this responsibility women need to have for each other and how we need to take charge of our lives and the choices that we make and what we allow others to do to us and how we allow ourselves to be treated. We need the conversation to be equally as powerful to the men of this world about them taking responsibility for the way they behave, for the words they say, the actions that they use, for the hurt that they create, and for the anger that is underlying so much of it. And we need to, I think, as a society, take responsibility for that. We have created that in deciding that this patriarchal version of the world was best for everyone. And that ultimately what we've done is create generations of subservient people-pleasing women who end up in dangerous situations and afraid, and generations of toxically masculine men who have this unbridled entitlement and anger because we haven't taught them how to be human or even said that it's okay for them to be human. So I think we need to balance this pendulum. I think we need to also have that conversation about what we're saying to our boys and how we're allowing our boys to be, who we're allowing them to be, and the cages we've put around them as much as the women they are trapping within them.
Oh, Kel, absolutely. And look, I saw Clementine Ford a couple of times on the weekend and, you know, I've dipped into her book, Boys Will Be Boys, but so many times on Facebook I've seen this argument come up, you know, and I have to say, and I'm sure you would agree, we're not talking about every man here. We're talking about masculinity in general in our society today. And we know that that doesn't fit every man that's out there. But the undeniable fact is that most domestic violence, 98% I think the figure is, or around that.
I think it's actually 99 to be
honest. Of domestic violence, yeah. It's perpetrated by men against women. So that's the baseline fact. Mm-hmm. But the thing that, you know, I think so many people and so many men miss about Clementine's arguments and ideas is that these notions that she's putting forward about toxic masculinity and that are being discussed in society now, changing all that is going to help men just as much as it's going to help women. You know, high suicide rate that is so often talked about, you know, and it's so often thrown back as an argument at feminists. What about all the men out there who are killing themselves because of, you know, evil feminism? No, they're not killing themselves because of horrible evil feminists. They're killing themselves because they have been put into boxes by our society to the extent that they cannot communicate, they can't connect with their emotions, they can't speak, they can't ask for help. And the arguments that Clementine is putting forward will help, you know, if we can change that, it's going to benefit men as well as women. You can probably hear it in my voice. It's like banging your head against a wall.
The frustration.
You know, don't you understand? Yeah. This is going to make society better for everybody. It's not just about
exactly.
The women.
Exactly. And it's not just women and men either. It's trans, non-binary individuals, anyone who wants to identify any goddamn way they please. It's about freeing everyone from every box and getting rid of this arrogant judgment that people have thinking that because they have made one choice, every other choice in the world is wrong and horrible and shouldn't be able to exist, or every other version is wrong. Cut the judgment out against other people. I think I just want to burn it all down to the ground, you know, and start fresh. Yeah.
But look, you know, on the plus side, these conversations are out there. You know, like I was so inspired when I came away. I mean, some other brilliant writers too there, you know, but these sort of more social issue type sessions that I went to, I just came away being so inspired, and the books are out there, the women are out there, men are out there speaking about this stuff. And, you know, I think it's actually really positive, and I think it's really hopeful that there's so much of this stuff being spoken about now, you know, and of course there's still lots of differences, but I think we're heading in the right direction. I think, and the younger generations of women coming through and men too are, you know, so much more open to diversity and non-judgment than I know when I was at school, you know, that everything had to be, everybody had to be normal, you know, and you had to look a certain way and be a certain way. And look, I'm sure that still exists, but it's changing. And I think that's a brilliant thing.
We're crushing the standard of normal. Let's get rid of the word normal, and just be. There shouldn't be any standard of anything except for being a human being who can exist towards other human beings with respect, kindness and compassion, like full stop. That's all it should be. But I think you made a really good point before about how men react in this really defensive way. And I feel like this is a phase. I feel like that just like with everything, just like how Australia is still grappling with our Indigenous past and those arguments still come out from white Australians and colonial Australians against Indigenous Australians when they say, hey, do you want to maybe recognise our plight over here and how we've actually lived and what you've actually done to us and how that's hurt and affected us as a community. Same thing's happening with men and women. And that is, it's got to do with fear. It's got to do with what that change means. It's got to do with the shame and loathing that's attached definitely to the idea that men have behaved this way, and by saying that they have, does that mean they have? Embrace the shame, because as a gender, men should 100% be ashamed. If women had behaved that way towards men, I would be damn ashamed of my gender. I am ashamed of my colonial past, 100%. And I stand here wanting our country to show more respect and humility towards our Indigenous First Nation Australians. As a woman, if women had done what men have done to women, if men were dying at the hands of women at the rate that women are dying at the hands of men, damn, I'd be ashamed. Yes, I would be ashamed. And I would stand tall and make it my purpose to awaken my community, my gender, to what we have done. Just like the church community is having to awaken to its own abuse and enablement. There is no shame in waking up to the shame. There is only shame in continuing to deny it because it's too uncomfortable for you to recognize what your history entails. We need to get uncomfortable, like a million people have already said. We need to get uncomfortable enough that we just can't look at ourselves anymore, because this is just not okay for our men and our women. And however somebody wants to express themselves in this world, because Jackie's sister could have died that night so easily. Jackie could have died had she stayed with the man, because even though it starts off so calm, we all know where it evolves to. That's the story of 1 in 3 women in Australia. Now, men have got to look at that when 99% of the perpetrators are from their gender. It may not be you, but if you're in a group, 1 in 3 of you somewhere is doing this, and you may not want to admit it. But until we all face it, people will die. People will be murdered. People will continue to perpetuate the cycle of abuse generation to generation because they live it and they see it.
Scary.
Girls and boys will grow up and commit suicide and nothing will change. It comes down to men waking up to their own shame and getting over themselves, I think. And because as much as women take personal responsibility, men have to stop being so bloody angry.
And so attached to power and control, and that's a whole that's a whole tunnel.
And so afraid. We have afraid of feeling. So we need to teach men that instead of translating every major feeling they have into anger and fear, to feel it, just like we've taught women to do. If we can teach that to one gender, can't we teach it to everybody? Anyway. Yeah.
So wise.
You can tell this is a passionate subject.
It is. It is. But I'm really looking forward to reading Jackie's book, though. And, you know, I loved the interview. And I just think, it's great just to have another voice out there telling, you know, inspiring women and trying to get people to be, you know, the best version of themselves and the best, for everybody around them.
Yeah, she's got a few principles in there that everybody should absolutely abide by. That is personal responsibility, own your choices, be real about who you are. Don't blame everyone else if your life isn't doing great. Look inwards first before you look outwards, because that's usually where you'll find the key. And you can only change yourself in a situation. You can't change others. The other one is intention. Ownership of your intention. Always come from a space with the right intention. If your intention is wrong, then your actions will be wrong and your relationships will suffer. And it's such basic stuff, but it's so true. And it's similar to what Pauline Nguyen and her book, Way of the Spiritual Entrepreneur, talks about. And funnily enough, I actually got that book and gave it to Jackie, because as soon as I read Jackie's book, I went, oh my goodness, she has to read Pauline.
Oh, that's so good. Bit of cross-fertilization.
I'm hoping those two go and do something. But I'm just going to say one quick thing outside of go and get Jackie's book, because it is worth it and you will take things from it. And it's written in a way that the everyday person can absolutely understand and enjoy. So it is for everyone. And you can get that at her website, www.exojackie.com. And you can find out all about the book and her tours. And if you want to get a reading from her and check out Jackie's Shine It Up tour, which will be coming out again and coming around this year. And of course, go and watch The Real Housewives of Melbourne and you'll find out all about her. Oh, and congratulations to Jackie, because I've just read that the book went number one on the Booktopia list.
Oh, so fantastic.
It's definitely doing well. Yeah.
Jackie was actually at Newcastle too, but I missed her because we had to leave to come home and she was on fairly late on Sunday. So, yeah, that was a shame. But so it was good to listen to the interview.
And, of course, thank you, everybody, for listening to this episode. This is a really important episode. Please do share it around. As many people who can hear this episode as possible, then maybe we can make a change. Maybe we can make a shift. Do go to 1-800-RESPECT if you've experienced any kinds of triggering or trauma as a result of listening to this episode, or if you or anyone you know is experiencing domestic violence, family violence, or sexual violence of any sort. Please do reach out. It's so important. And of course, you can find us at www.rightsforwomen.com, and you can find Pam at
PamelaCook.com.au.
And we're on social media, and you can grab us in all of your podcatchers. Thank you again for another great chat, Pam. And on that note, I'm going to say bye.
Okay.
Bye, bye.
This podcast episode was recorded, produced, and edited by Kel Butler from Listen Up Podcasting.